The first time I knew, oh, I'm an anxious person was probably the first time that I had my first panic attack. But again, I never had a panic attack, so I didn't know what was going on. So my first thought was like, oh, death. I was like, this is how I die. So in my head, I was like, I have two choices. I can call the hospital. If there's any chance that I'm going to survive this, should I call the hospital so they can come to me? Or like, is this too far gone and I should call my mom and just be like, mom, this is it.
I'm dying now,
so I wanted to say goodbye. Those were my thoughts.
This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in again. It's Wednesday. It's been an awesome couple of weeks on the show, awesome few weeks on the show. We've had some great interviews and some good shows. You know, today with me, I did a great interview. Great conversation with Christy Weepy, who is the assistant director of the Pain Psychology Center in Los Angeles. Christy is working on a project right now in Boulder, Colorado, utilizing fMRIs and the use of psychotherapy to cure chronic pain. She's all over the internet. You can find the center all over the internet, Alan Gordon, Christy Weepy, and some of the other therapists that are a part of the center. Really pretty amazing conversation. We go into depth about where it originated for her, and actually that she had interviewed at this site as being somebody that had chronic pain problems and hadn't even read the Sarno stuff yet, like didn't know that it was there. And now she's got a hold of all this kind of stuff and she's helping cure people all around the world. I think it's amazing. So this is about 45 minutes. I think you're going to enjoy it. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I'm your host, Eddie, and I'm here with Associate Director of the Pain Psychology Center in Los Angeles, Christy Weepy. How are you?
I'm good, Eddie. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm really good. I'm so excited that we got an opportunity to connect. I've been following Alan for so long, and I've looked at a lot of the materials on the website. I've read through the bios, I feel like, of just about every person that's in the bio, but you're there right at the top. You've got a YouTube series as well called Feelings and Stuff, which I think is awesome. But, you know, initially what caught my eye on you is I've gone through and I've done the 21-day program that Alan Gordon did. There's a couple of different ones that are available on the TMS Wiki. There's kind of the more, hey, read all this stuff program. And then there's the more, here's the audio visual, if that's how you are as a learner one. Mm-hmm. And he has like a recording on there. It kind of talks a little bit about your story. You do this for a living now. You help people solve their chronic pain conundrums that they've had for so long. And that's what this, you know, by the time that this airs, this will be the 22nd episode that I've done on this topic.
Wow.
So I want to know your background. Like, I know that this affected your life for a long time, like chronic pain. How did it start? Where did it start? When did it start? Let's start there.
Okay. I had pain symptoms and anxiety symptoms probably for as long as I can remember, but I didn't have any ability to distinguish them as psychogenic symptoms, to even name them as caused by anxiety. The real start of when I knew something was wrong was probably in college. I had knee pain. I had knee pain for about 2 years, and I just chalked it up to I'm running too much or I'm putting weight on it funny. And then from there, things just started falling apart a little bit like Humpty Dumpty. So I had knee pain for a couple of years when that just kind of magically went away. At the same time, I had hamstring pain pop up, and then I had that for a couple of years. And then that just kind of magically went away. At the same time, my neck pain popped up. But you know how it is when you have all these new pain symptoms and you're not knowledgeable about psychogenic pain, about TMS. You just truly think something is physically wrong with you every single time. So I actually interviewed for the Pain Psychology Center during my graduate school stint at USC. I was getting my MSW, and I interviewed for the Pain Psychology Center, interested in the field of chronic pain, still having absolutely no idea that I was suffering from TMS and that they might actually be able to help me. Like, I literally probably ripped off a heating pad and popped a painkiller before I walked into the interview.
What years are we approximately talking about at this point?
So when did I graduate? I would have interviewed for them in 2015.
Okay, so 2015. And so, you know, by this point, like, healing back pain. I mean, even like the Mind-Body prescription would have been out. I mean, I think they came out in 98 or 99. Like it was around for 15 or 16 years. You had no exposure to to that work at this point in time.
No.
It's interesting that like, so I have a minor in psychology, but I took 50 credits of it. Okay, so that's something, which is different on the California unit system. My parents went to Chico State. I know the system. Like it's a little different, but I guess like what led you into, there's so many different avenues that you can go into when you're going to school for psychotherapy. What what brought you into the chronic pain realm? Because I think it's so interesting that eventually like these intersections, you know, they met, right? Like you, like they eventually collided and it was like, oh, I have all these problems. Oh, I want to interview at this place. Oh, hey, maybe this is the answer. What took you into like chronic pain being what you wanted to look into as a, like a, you know, a domain?
Okay. I'm going to give you a logical answer and then I'm going to give you the truthful answer. So logically speaking, I did experience a tremendous amount of pain. I knew that I had pain symptoms for years and years and years. And I realized, okay, this center, apparently psychotherapy can help with pain. I just had put myself in a category of, well, I can't be helped because my pain is physical. My pain is structural, but I know what pain is like. So if I could help someone else with another category of pain, I'd love to learn how to do that.
Yeah.
Not realizing that I absolutely fit the bill and absolutely could benefit from the treatment. So logically, yes, I knew it was something that I was interested in, but I'm going to be honest. I bumped into Alan Gordon, the director of our center at school one day. And he recognized me because I was in the club that he ran, but we didn't know each other too well. And I literally just bumped into him one day and he threw it out there like, hey, I run one of the internships for your graduate level internship. Will you interview at my center? And being the total people pleaser that I am, like anxious mess at this time, I said yes. I said I would interview. I had like no idea what he was talking about. I was not planning on specializing in this. I thought I was going to work in like social justice reform. But I said yes, and I was too scared to tell him, like, I don't know if I want to do that. So I went to the interview and got it. And then this has become my whole career.
Yeah, no kidding. Like, gosh, what a way. the path is amazing. So like, so you go in, you interview, you get it. How long is it before you connect the dots? And because I know, like, at least the way the program reads, it seems like Alan treated you. Is that right?
So Alan definitely helped me a lot. Here's how it went down. I had been in and out of every physical therapist, chiropractor, doctor in Los Angeles for years. And I had a ton of structural explanations for my pain. Granted, they didn't make any sense, but I believed them at the time. Like I had doctors tell me, of course your neck hurts. Your neck is so long. We've never seen a neck as long as yours.
Oh, I was God. Like,
oh my God, I was like embarrassed about my neck. Like I am some kind of giraffe freak. Like I had every explanation in the book. So I took the internship in part because I felt pressured to do so, in part because I was super interested in the work of pain. And it wasn't until we had a summer break in between our first year of grad school and our second year, and we had two books assigned to us, Sarno's Mind-Body Prescription and Schubiner's Unlearn Your Pain. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until literally 2 weeks before I started actually at the internship taking on patients of my own that I realized, oh my God, I am on every page of this book. This is what I have.
Yep. How long before you started getting some relief? Like from the, you know, from when you read the first few pages of the first book, like, I guess how long did it take before you started like actually seeing a good dent in the symptoms that you were having?
I would say within 2 weeks, I had a pretty sharp drop off. My symptoms probably reduced about 40 to 50% in a couple of weeks, just being educated on the existence of psychogenic pain and some of the contributing factors. Where Alan really came in was in my training, helping me realize not just that psychogenic pain exists and here's how it might exist, but here's how you can respond to it in an effective way to break the cycle. So Alan helped me tremendously in that regard.
So that's like one. So I'm a part of a few different like groups on Facebook, people that are like, there's one that, have you read Steve Ozanich's book, by the way?
I've read parts of it.
Okay, so I interviewed him back in December or January, which, by the way, like that's awesome. That the downloads on that still get triple digits every single week. It's still downloaded almost more than anything else. And like I had like Nicole Sachs on the show. Like but Steve's by far like people I think go and they seek what it is, because, you know, at this point, like Sarno's got, if you look at his four books, he's up to somewhere around 5,000 or 6,000 reviews on Amazon at this point. Mm-hmm. And Ozanich is somewhere around 1,000 between his two books. And so, but there was still points where I was having trouble connecting the dots. And then I talked to Valerie Sadin. Uh-huh. And she had said, hey, have you taken a look at Alan's 21-day program? And there was a lot of stuff in there that I hadn't even thought about. Somatic tracking, like things like that.
Yeah.
I guess for the Facebook groups I'm in where people just seem to be struggling, some of them have been struggling for years, and some of them say, you know, I read this book once through and I still hurt, and so it's not for me. Like, what's the sticking point for a lot of people, whether it's with clients or with yourself, or, you know, where do people have a block?
Okay. I think some people, when they read something like Sivo's book or a Sarno book, I think some people read it, get symptom relief, get super excited about that, go online, write a review, say, I feel way better. This is me. They're so excited that this diagnosis fits them. I think for half of the people, that really is enough. Just knowing what's going on in them, understanding that there is a diagnosis, that their body is structurally sound. I think for about half of the people, that can really work. I think for the other half of the people, even if that initial rush, that excitement of, oh my God, someone else knows what I'm going through and this is a legitimate diagnosis, I'm not just making this up, or my doctors aren't just all throwing out wrong diagnoses at me. It's not enough for them because they haven't been taught to respond to the pain in a way that effectively neutralizes the pain cycle. And I think what's even worse than that is that if they finish one of those books and they say, all right, I'm supposed to feel better now, I know what I have, there's nothing wrong with me, and they don't feel better, I think it terrifies people and it makes them feel like, if this was it and I'm still not better, then what the heck is wrong with me?
And maybe it's even a regression at that point.
100%. Yeah, I think it can make symptoms worse, at least temporarily.
What's been the overall, like, it seems like, I asked Nicole Sachs this in October, November. I kind of, you know, what is the really like the future of medicine? How do you see mind-body connection stuff, psychogenic pain being accepted by the medical community, you know, MDs in the next 5 years or 10 years? Because with me, like, you know, I saw 25 specialists. I spent probably $10,000. I had my, mm-hmm. I had shoulder surgery. I had neck procedure done. You know, I had MRIs and X-rays and injections and all that stuff. And then I went to an MD, a doctor. She's the doctor for the Huskies football team. Like, we're both in the Pac-12, so you speak my language, right? she, you know, she examined everything. She saw my positive EMG results that said you have you have pinched nerves here, you have nerve impingements over here. And she just said, what's your stress level like? And actually asked me about my life. Oh, and that changed everything, right? Like, so the first 24 people said nothing of the sort. And then she had something 180 degrees different.
Yeah.
So you're probably, like Schubiner's very involved. You're right. And you're not far from Schechter. Like, how do you see maybe the guard changing in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years?
So I think what we have stacked up against us is that some doctors, when they hear the idea of mind-body connection, just cast it off into a separate category of alternative medicine or new agey, like woo-woo medicine. And they think of themselves as the science-based folks, the people who treat things from a certain perspective that's research-based. And then they look at us, so to speak, as a totally different category, an alternative treatment that maybe it works for some people, but we don't really know why. I think what doctors are waiting for is evidence that this treatment approach, that a psychological approach to pain actually has bearing, is of significance, which is why me and Alan are spending so much time with our team out. We're doing a research study out of UC Boulder right now with Tor Wager, and we're doing everything we can to document the effects, the changes in the brain pre and post treatment in back pain patients, to try to get our foot in the door, to go to doctors and say, this isn't an alternative treatment to chronic pain. it is the treatment for chronic pain.
So MRIs are a huge deal in the medical community. That was the first thing I was pointed at to go and get my neck MRI, my shoulder MRI. And one of the first things that really caught my eye about Alan and how I heard about him was that story on, I think like the show, The Doctors, right? There was the kid, kid who was the baseball player, and they did an fMRI before treatment and an fMRI after. And his amygdala went from, you know, this, like, it's like on fire to now it's calm and it's chilled out and it's like blue or whatever the color that they want is. Is that what's going on in Boulder?
Yes, exactly. Well, that would definitely be the hope. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is we're taking back pain patients who've been screened by Dr. Schubiner first. So they have had a medical consultation. They've ruled out anything that's structural or physical. And then they get an fMRI scan of their brain before we start treatment. And then we use our treatment approach. It's pain reprocessing therapy. It's a psychological treatment approach. We meet them twice a week for 4 weeks for a total of 8 sessions. And then we do an fMRI scan again at the end of treatment. And we're exactly hoping for that.
Yeah.
Essentially from on fire to nice, calm blue colors.
I think there has to be a feelings and stuff about this, but I think about when I first saw that, I thought of the fireball that Mario like would shoot on the old Nintendo game. Right.
Oh my God. So it's like, exactly that.
So like if there's ever a video done that's on it, you've got to at least get like the Mario tune in the back, right? Like people will get it. I think
amazing.
People will get it.
Amazing.
Are there any like preliminary, I think Alan's been there for, he's been going back and forth for a few months, right? Like, is there any preliminary results on anybody yet that you're at liberty to share?
The only thing we can share is that results are promising and we're really excited to be able to share the specifics as soon as we wrap up. It's a huge endeavor for everyone in Colorado on the back end. Yoni Ashar is doing all of the fMRIs, Tor Wager is reading all of it. But Alan and I are literally flying back from LA to Colorado just on repeat. It's like we live in, I feel like I'm in the movie Up in the Air. So it's been taking a little bit longer than anticipated. It's a big study.
Do you have, I hope you have like an Alaska Airlines card or something that you're using. Get your miles.
Listen, I'm going to be honest, I've done a lot of work on my anxiety, obviously, and on my pain, and I feel great most of the time. But my sticking point in life has been flying. I hate flying.
Is it getting better over time? Gosh,
oh my God, what a fantastic look into the benefits of exposure. I mean, if you fly 4 times a week, there's no way that your flying anxiety can't get better. So that has been one shining silver lining for me.
So it's going to sort of feel like a hard left turn, but I'll show you where the segue is from flying and anxiety to where I'm going. Okay. So, so like I didn't think of, when I first read Sarno's, so I found Sarno's book maybe 4 days after he died. Like it was like, it was like the universe just sort of lined up in that way. I read his book. I didn't think of it as, I didn't make the connection to anxiety because it's so rage, 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 right? Like that's the nucleus of the book. But then right. I read the obituary in the New York Times, which said something about, you know, legendary doctor dies who tied back pain to anxieties or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess like the way that I've kind of thought about TMS in the last 9 months has sort of evolved over time. And now to me, the way that I best explain it to somebody in an elevator when I have 30 seconds, if for some reason I'm telling them about this, I would say it's anxiety expressing itself in the form of back or neck pain. Like that's kind of the most simple way that I can think of it. You talk about like having anxiety. We can all accept we get on an airplane. Many of us who we don't say that we're anxious people, but like for a long time, for years, until 2010, the plane would take off. I get the sweaty palms. I grab my wife's hand and like, you know, dig my nails into it. Like that's a physiological response to an emotional stimulus, right? Like we can accept that. But like, I guess, you know, what is it about people that I know that sometimes an equivalent to TMS is anxiety. And so like, is there like a prototype patient that you can describe? I mean, we all kind of say we see ourselves on every page, but what does that actually mean? Right. What's a prototype patient?
That's a really good question. So I think what trips some people up when they start diving into this work and hearing things like back pain, neck pain can be a manifestation of anxiety is the prototype of someone with chronic pain is generally someone who's very high functioning, oftentimes very well liked, a people person, someone who has a high position at their job or their job requires them to talk a lot or mingle a lot or be an extrovert, someone who has a lot of pressure on their shoulders and handles it well, is the prototype of someone that we're working with. They're do-gooders, they're people pleasers, they hold themselves to high standards, and they get it done. Like, they're the go-to people for anything that you need in your business or in your personal life. So when you start introducing the idea of anxiety to them, oftentimes they outright reject it and say, that can't be right. That's not my experience. I'm not shy. In fact, look at all that I do for all of these people, how many people come to me throughout the day, and I'm able to help so many people in my life. I can't be anxious. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a confusion between anxiety and social anxiety and shyness. And I think people are conflating those two terms. And when they hear anxiety, they think someone who's shy, someone who doesn't want to leave the house, someone who doesn't want to talk to people or who can't handle things. And that's not true at all. Anxiety is your system responding to threat. And that can all be happening internally. Your system can be on fire, and you might be presenting to the world as Mr. or Mrs. Can Do It All.
Right. Oh, like in the 2020 special, the guy who's always smiling because he's, you know, even though he's in pain all the time. Is that kind of what you mean?
Exactly. The guy who's always smiling and is successful and getting lots of things done, and yet is in chronic pain and probably in crippling anxiety.
So do you find yourself like one of the things that I think the thing that I like the most about the YouTube series is that you in particular seem very, I don't know if like vulnerable is the best word, right? But like it sort of seems like, here, this is me, this is who I am, and you know, take it or leave it, right? Like you're pretty real, like in what it is that that these like challenges maybe that you go through or that people go through or whatever. But like, do you see, you know, you don't really have so much of the physical pain anymore, but what do you bounce between, or do you bounce? Because in the most recent video I watched, you had talked about people not necessarily doing the things in a daily practice that maybe can reduce some of their anxieties. So do you find yourself bouncing between, you know, fully healthy, you know, asymptomatic 100% to maybe, you know, I'm having an anxious moment or two, or my neck is starting to hurt a little bit. Like, you know, you're human. Like, what does that look like for you now that you know, you know where it comes from, you know how to fix it. What's your life like?
So I actually love what's going on in my body right now, because my neck and my neck pain is an incredibly helpful indicator to me at this point in my life. I'm not in chronic pain like I used to be. I do not wake up every day in pain. It is not the center of my life. I experience pain maybe once every couple of weeks. But when that turns on, when my neck tightens up, it is tremendously helpful to me. It is literally like a warning light from my brain saying, hey, you're overwhelming yourself. You're not attending to yourself. You need to slow down and regulate. So I feel like I have this built-in magical system that lets me know when I'm riding myself too hard or when I'm not stopping and taking care of myself. And I think of it like that. I don't get tripped up about it. It doesn't make me feel like I'm relapsing or like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm treating pain patients and here I am in pain myself. That's how my body lets me know I need to chill out. That's how my body lets me know I need to attend to myself. I think it's really helpful.
So you get to the I need to slow down and attend to myself. What does that mean for you? What are some of the things that you personally do?
So for me, I do a lot of body-based and cognitive-based safety work. So body-based safety work would mean to me closing my eyes, taking a few deep breaths, literally slowing my system down and asking myself to drop back into my body, as opposed to running around trying to do a million things and totally disconnecting from myself.
Yep.
And then cognitively, this is really simple, but I've done this since day one of my recovery when I was reading Sarno's book. I tell myself throughout the day, every day, multiple times a day, Christy, you're safe. You're okay. You're doing a good job. Everything's all right.
Yep.
I've never stopped doing that.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. One of the people that's in the, I mean, it almost seems like it's its own industry now. There's so many different books and authors. Like there's, you know, Schechter and Schubiner and Sarno and Ozanich and Sachs and there's like there's Adam Heller, right, who has Zero Pain Now. I don't know if you've heard of the program, but one of the his in there, it gets some criticism. It took me a long time to sort of understand what it is that he's saying in there. I think first time that I had read that book, like I was still, you know, I don't know about struggling. I'd understood the concept, but I didn't understand the part about checking in with myself, which Alan says a lot in his videos, checking in with yourself. And Adams is very much like, you know, right now, what emotion am I feeling? And I would just sort of ask myself that, but it was just like very, very surface level. And then I reread one of the pages, which says a lot of people tend to get in their own head when they do this. So think about that area between your, I think he says between your stomach and your heart, because that's where a lot of people tend to like sort of trap their negative emotions. And I noticed that paired with the idea of like somatic tracking that that Alan talks about in the program is tremendously helpful. It seems like that would be a great tip for somebody checking in with themselves, the way that you describe it, right? Getting inside of your own body and actually you know, dealing with it.
I love that. And I love that for a couple of reasons, but primarily because you're mixing a couple different things that you've heard, which doesn't surprise me at all, given how much you know about this and your confidence in the field. But patients can get caught up on like, but what technique do I use? This person says something different from that person. Which one do I use at what time? Like, you got to do what works for you. And sometimes you take some pieces and leave other pieces. Whatever makes you feel safe and grounded is the right thing to do every time.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so you're in tight with Schubiner. And
I love Schubiner.
Do you know who there's a movie that's going to be released, like pretty much featuring him, called This Will Hurt. It's, the trailer's been out for like 2 years, and I haven't seen anything else about it. I don't know if you have or not. But it looks amazing. I watched the trailer over and over.
It looks so good.
Yeah, like, but I don't, and like the All the Rage movie, I loved that. And I've talked to Michael Galinsky, the guy who made the movie, and eventually I'm going to interview him. But so Schubiner, and then so he's one of the guys that's working on this right now. And obviously, like, he's probably sees some crazy cases of, you know, people with herniated discs and stenosis and all the things that Sarno lists in there. Like, I guess maybe anecdotally, what are some of the, you know, confidentiality, of course, like I don't need names or anything more specifics about patients, but like, what are some of the more extreme diagnosis that people have been given? And then sort of they've gotten maybe the stamp of approval from Schubiner that, no, I think this is more psychogenic in nature. And then you guys have had success in treating them.
Oh my God. I'm so glad you asked me this question, because it lets me talk about one of my favorite patients ever. I had a patient whose neck was literally turned the wrong way. So she was facing, her body would be facing forward, but her neck was facing backward, and she couldn't move it forward even if she pushed on it.
Oh my God. Is that the muscular tension was holding it?
Yeah. Yeah. And there, you know what, there is a medical word for it that's of course escaping me right now, but they were like, yeah, I mean, we'll call it this, but it doesn't make any sense with what you're, I don't know why it's stuck like
that. Yeah.
That's so wild. She was cleared of anything. And it was like, we did, I met with her over Skype, and she would literally, she couldn't do a computer because she couldn't look at it right. So she had to put Skype on her phone, video conferencing, and hold the phone behind her to match it up to where her eyes and her head were facing. It was crazy.
Oh my God. And then, and so she, like, this is somebody that you were able to bring out of the weeds and kind of get her life back.
Yeah, you know what was so interesting about her is that she had anxiety and headaches for years, and she just never listened to those warning lights. She was like, I don't have time to deal with this. Like, my head hurts, whatever, I'm pushing through. And it almost felt like her brain got to a point where it was like, if you're not going to listen to the headaches, we're going to give you something that will not let you walk. It won't let you drive.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to be the supermom and the whatever, everything that she was doing, she was just bedridden until slowly, week after week, it was like she'd get on every week and her head would be a little bit more facing forward until she like got on one day and was facing me head on. And I was like, oh my God, you're looking at me. Yeah.
I can see your chest and your face in the same window.
Exactly.
That's wild. Exactly. See, now headaches migrate. Like, when I first started reading about this stuff, I remember telling my wife, like, yeah, my back hurts, my neck hurts, you know, I've had back, neck, shoulder, stomach, knees, sciatica. I've had all those things, but I would keep telling her, at least I don't have migraines, right? Because to me, they seem like maybe the worst. And like, I know a few people that have had chronic migraines, you know, as long as I've known them, 10 or 15 or 20 years or whatever. Mm. But, you know, they don't necessarily want to take my advice on the, you know, check out out the book or start looking into this stuff. So that's been a bit of a battle. But the there's a woman who does she does like consulting, corporate training at my wife's company. And I remember I used to work at this company, and I she had pulled, what was it? She pulled up something in a training that my wife was in. And then I wrote a blog last summer about, I think it was even my first one after I found the Sarno book, where it's basically like, okay, guys, my life has changed. I know I keep posting about all the different doctors I'm seeing, but this is totally different. But the image that I used for it was the same that this woman used in her training. And my wife was like, huh, like it was like, it wasn't a very generic picture. Like it was one that, we would have had to have been thinking on the same wavelength. So I was downstairs in that office. And this woman walked by, and I said, hey, like, I know you and I have never met, and call me crazy, right? Like, but my wife happened to be in on a training of yours, and she told me about this picture used. It's like this one. And I was talking about Dr. John Sarno in this, and she sits, this is a woman that charges like $300 an hour to train with her. She sits down. We talked for 45 minutes to an hour about Sarno because she had chronic migraines for like 20 or 25 years. And she said through the book, what she learned is that her migraines were not being caused by some kind of a medical issue, but it had much more to do with her dad throwing plates at her mom when she was a little kid.
Oh my God.
And I was saying like, whoa. And she's like, and when I finished and you know, recognized stuff, she's like, the migraines went away and I haven't had one for 10 years or something like that.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
Yeah. And
that
I was just,
such a cool story.
Yeah. I was just thinking like, wow, like kindred spirits, right? Like how did we run into each other in this particular moment? Like how wild that was. And it brought me in like, cause I work in the, I work in the software world. Like that's my primary day job. And, you know, I work with a lot of executives and, you know, people that are very, very high, like these are like top performing, high achieving salespeople, which is exactly how I got my symptoms, right? Yeah. Being a high achieving, record setting, like President's Club award winner. But I interviewed a guy last week. He's a sales trainer in Australia, and the episode with him actually aired today as we record this. But I had asked him, he had 29 years of back pain, broke into tears and wept on our podcast. It was kind of an amazing moment, but he said that, we got into talking about how this Sarno knowledge has changed how he's consulted with executives over time. And he says, like, he sees that there's, you know, that there's a big medical problem. He says, I use that, those kind of approaches, I think, in terms of like, you know, lower stress environments and really just, I don't know, I guess being more cognizant and not just doing the grind of the daily, you know, the daily corporate thing. And I guess like for me, and as you work with people that are probably in all different types of industries and things like that, I guess, is it at all concerning maybe about how much more of a stressful world we've become, or like as time goes on, like, I think it's only going to get worse, right? Like the, I don't know, like this, there was a lot of talk about this in the All the Rage movie about, you know, deindustrialization and lack of investments in certain neighborhoods. And I don't know, I guess like talk a little bit about maybe societal changes and stressful work environments, kind of how all these things sort of plug into what could be maybe a bigger epidemic problem as you guys are on the other side trying to bring this more to the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of validity to what you're saying. Even just, not even just in my clinical practice, I mean, I'm sure we both see it in our friends and family all the time. There's just this culture of insufficiency right now. Like none of us feel like we have enough, that we're doing enough. The idea of taking care of yourself, the idea of taking a day off or a vacation somehow has become like not cool. It's like, oh, you need a break? I don't. I'm over here grinding every day, 24/7, making it work. And it's really, really unhealthy that we're idolizing this idea of never stopping, never need to stop, never need to take a break, never need any help.
Yep.
I'm moving, 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 moving. I think that's a huge part of it. And I think it comes from just deep set insecurities of feeling like we are not enough and making up for it by feeling like we're doing enough at all times. I think that's a big part of it. And then I think social media and comparison is a huge part of it. Not only just seeing constantly certain images of people having what you don't, but also just being completely disconnected from the actual people in the present moment around you and being caught up in your phone is just an anxiety producer in and of itself.
I think you guys did a feelings and stuff about that topic,
the social media part
of it.
Yeah, because it's messing people up. I mean, we know our phones and these apps are designed to be addictive, but I also think they're literally designed to make our anxiety go up. We become so dependent on the whatever it is, the app, the messaging, the Facebook feed, to distract us and to make us feel calmer and safer. And it's really scary.
I mean, I definitely find myself, and I hate, I've got a colleague, she went off camping in, I want to say it was like Mexico or something not long ago, but she told me that, like, she's in sales as well. She's like, you know, I got to the campsite with my family and we had zero cell phone service, and it freaked me out for the first 5 minutes because, you know, what if a customer emails me? What about this? She's like, and I didn't have access to a phone or the internet for 3 days, and it was literally the best thing ever, right?
Like, yes!
you get out of that, and how nice that break was.
Yeah, because it lets your brain shut off for a second. Like, even I think people think it's not a big deal if my phone is near me or I didn't even check that text message. Even just it coming in creates a pressure in the back of your mind, like, I need to check that, I need to respond to that. And if that's happening a million times a day, your brain is going too fast.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and like, I feel like the habits that we form, whether it's picking up a phone and checking Facebook and scrolling through, even when you don't have a notification, right? Or like, just checking stuff for the sake of checking it, doing the little, you know, you press the email button and then you scroll to see if you have anything, even though it's, you know, it's like an REI junk mail, like stuff you don't even need to look at. Those become like an ingrained, like, subconscious habits. And so one thing that I think maybe some people can struggle with in this whole concept is the idea of conscious, subconscious, unconscious. Mm-hmm. I guess briefly explain the three layers to me and what the difference between them is and how they play a role into TMS.
Okay, so I think we can pull in Sarno here for a second because he talks a lot about unconscious rage. And you brought up earlier that it seems almost like we're talking about two different things. We're talking about something going on in our unconscious that maybe has to do with emotions and rage. And then we're also having what feels almost like a separate discussion around anxiety and fear. So I want to bridge that gap for a second. Any emotion can be scary to the person experiencing it for a variety of reasons. Like, if you grew up in a household where your mom never cried in front of you, or you got in trouble when you cried, sadness can be really scary for you. So at some point you might have taught yourself, when that feeling comes on, that's dangerous and not safe and not good and not appreciated in my home. So you send it away. You suppress it on purpose. If you do that often enough, if every time sadness comes on, you say, no, this is really scary, I don't want to feel this, this is scary, I don't want to do this, eventually your brain learns to send the emotion away before you've even realized that you've sent it away and before you've even had awareness that you're feeling it. So eventually, actively suppressing the emotion, pushing it down on purpose, becomes inadvertently repressing the emotion, not even being aware that sadness is there, and sub out sadness for anger or what have you, rage, like Sarno talks about. So why I bring any of this up is emotions can come up in our unconscious and we can have absolutely no conscious awareness that they're even there for us. But when that process takes place, the danger system of our brain is activated because our brain is saying that emotion is scary, send it away. And that danger system getting activated is what causes pain and anxiety. Pain and anxiety are danger signals that come on when our danger system is activated. Our danger system can be activated by unconscious emotions, including rage, but not limited to rage.
My therapist, who he retired a couple of months ago, but he was like one of the only, I felt like maybe the only one in Seattle that knew about Dr. Sarno, which was such a blessing. It was the first guy I called after I'd found the book. But we were talking about that concept, and he said what cleared it up for me was that he related it to PTSD, and said we're talking about basically the same thing here. He kept calling it the alligator part of the brain. He would always just call it the alligator after that, and I would know what he was thinking or what it was that he was saying or meaning. But it's the same idea, right?
Absolutely. It happens in, we call it the primitive part of our brain sometimes at the Pain Psychology Center. That part of your brain is really just concerned with assessing for threat and anything can be threatening. The midterm that you have tomorrow might be something that you're consciously afraid of and feeling might be threatening to you. Emotions that were taught to you or not taught to you when you were growing up can unconsciously be scary and threatening for you. And all that threat happens in that alligator brain, like you were saying.
So when in Sarno's book, I feel like he didn't bounce back and forth, but I would get the sense sometimes that a lot of what he was saying, like typical, and I'm using quotation fingers, like typical sufferers of this are people that had these, I don't want to say bad childhoods, because everybody interprets, like, what's traumatic to one person may not be traumatic to another, right? Like my daughter, like 3 weeks ago, we woke up in our house to smoke filled in upstairs, all the alarms going off.
Oh my God.
And like my daughter, like it ended up just being our furnace blower went out. And, but my daughter, like if she hears a loud beep, and she's only four, so it's really, really hard. Like right now, like if she hears a beep, whether it's a smoke alarm that's coming out of batteries, or if it's just like a beep from the TV, like her hands are on her ears. She's screaming because she thinks it's that moment. Right. So like that's really tough. Right. But maybe to another kid, like that's not traumatic at all. So we interpret traumas in different ways. I guess, what would you say to people that maybe didn't have, like, I come across people all the time, and I get Instagram messages from people that somehow have found me. I don't know how they have. They're in different countries. They're in Taiwan. They're in Ireland. Like, I don't know how, but they may say something to me like, hey, all this stuff that you talk about has a lot to do with, like, bad childhoods. And, like, me personally, like, the way that I remember it, I had a great childhood. And so what about the people that maybe they had a great childhood, but maybe they're still having a hard time getting over the finish line on that? Is it more just you put so much pressure on yourself and so you go the day-to-day route? Like as a person, maybe you're just a little bit more anxiety-ridden. You don't necessarily have to be beat up as a kid, but it could happen to some people. I guess what's the two different camps there for you?
This is one of my favorite questions because we get asked that a lot by our patients as well. Like people almost feel like they don't deserve the diagnosis unless they've hit a certain number of big T traumas in their life. But our relationship with fear can be corrupted for a variety of reasons, big and small. So sure, there's one camp of people who might label their childhood holistically as bad or traumatic, and they've had really actually terrible abuses occur to them. So the idea of their relationship with fear and safety being formed as a function of all those traumas makes perfect sense. The idea of having a mind-body disorder makes perfect sense. But that's actually not the vast majority of people that we work with, and it wasn't my story either. I mean, I had an awesome childhood. I love my parents to pieces, but my dad was super anxious, so my system grew up regulating to that. My mom was super avoidant of emotions. If she ever felt like she had to cry, she would literally run into a different room, which gave me the message like, okay, emotions aren't good. Don't ever feel that.
Yeah.
They weren't doing anything wrong or on purpose. I mean, they loved me so much. I had a wonderful childhood, but just those couple of things impacted my relationship with fear and with emotions enough for me to have pretty crippling anxiety throughout high school and college. So it's totally relative.
I mean, you sit in the LA traffic every day.
So. I cannot with it.
Are you in Los Angeles proper or one of the suburbs around there?
So our office is in Beverly Hills. I live in North Hollywood because the idea of living in Beverly Hills makes my skin crawl a little bit.
Yeah. Are they like straight up like Rodeo Drive, like Beverly Hills?
That's where our office is. Yeah, pretty much. Just a couple blocks away.
Wow. I thought it was just like Julia Roberts, but now it's Julia Roberts and the pain psychologist.
Exactly.
So we're wrapping up. I guess like the curious things remaining on the brain is like, when can people expect to maybe see some of the published or public results from what's going on with you guys in Boulder?
So I don't think that study will be published until a year from now, which feels so far away to me as I say it. I'm not sure if that means that there's no chance of us sharing some of the results earlier, but in terms of when you can read this, send it to your friends, show it to your doctor, I'd aim for about a year from now.
And then tell me about the center, because you guys were, I mean, I know from talking to Valerie, like you guys work remotely with people. We're using Skype to do this interview. Like the internet is a tremendous advantage, I feel like, for people in this. Like I remember I talked to a guy who does this, but he's out of Ipswich, England, and he works with clients all over the world. That's what the internet has given us. So talk about your practice with clients and what you guys can do as a center, whether somebody is local to Beverly Hills or whether they're elsewhere in the country or elsewhere in the world?
Awesome. So we do have an in-person center in Beverly Hills. If you want to work on your pain-related, anxiety-related, whatever, or if you just want a therapist, come on down, see us, we'll meet you in person. But unfortunately, there are very few people who specialize in the treatment of chronic pain from a psychological approach, not only in California or in the States, but across the world. So yeah, we have people from pretty much all different countries calling us and saying, we've gone everywhere, no one gets this, can you help us? So for those people, we meet them over Skype. We call it psychogenic pain coaching, and we'll teach you everything we know about the mechanisms of pain and what you need to do to break the pain cycle.
That's awesome. The only thing that we didn't get to that maybe at some point in the future we can do a part two, but it, like, I had it written down as a topic, but we took 45 minutes to run through everything we talked about already. But one thing, aside from watching the thing on The Doctors with Alan on it, the other thing that brought me to look into the Pain Psychology Center as a potential resource was there was a story of a guy who was an opioid addict who worked with Dan Lyman, who was cured of his pain, cured of his addiction to opioids. And I think that the conversation in the United States around painkillers, knowing that we take somewhere between 80% and 90% of the world's pain medicine is amazing. And I'm sure it's something that you guys are actively dealing with.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it feels like people like you and me and other people in this niche are sitting on somewhat of a landmine of information that could help millions of people. And it literally feels like life or death. So the more we do things like this, we do podcasts, we do research, we share with our family and friends. I mean, it is life or death information for people who are in that addiction cycle.
Absolutely. Okay, cool. Well, you can find Christy at thepainpsychologycenter.com, and she's got she's got feelings and stuff on YouTube. Is there anywhere else that people can find you guys or you?
Our Facebook and our YouTube and our Instagram for feelings and stuff. But other than that, I think that's enough of me. My face is everywhere right now.
Okay, awesome. Well, thanks so much for your time, Christy.
Thank you so much. Yeah, yeah. This was fun. I appreciate it.